Hear ye, all persons having any business before this honorable Supreme Court of the State of Hawaii, draw nigh. Give your attention, and you shall hear.
Please call the case.
Case number SCWC-15663, Field versus the National Collegiate Athletic Association. Arguing for the petitioner, Amy Brantley. Also appearing for the petitioner, Frederick Rolfing. Arguing for the respondent, Gregory L. Kirtner. Also appearing for the respondent, William C. McCorriston. Argument on the merits.
All right. Good morning, Ms. Brantley and Mr. Kirtner and our other attorneys here today. Are you both ready to proceed with your arguments? All right. And Ms. Brantley, you've asked to reserve 10 minutes for rebuttal. We'll give you a warning light when you're at 10 minutes to go in your argument. Mr. Kirtner, we will give you a warning with 5 minutes to go. Please proceed.
Good morning. Chief Justice Rechtenwald and Honorable Justices, may it please the Court. The bankruptcy estate of Aloha Sports, Inc. brings this petition because it believes that the Intermediate Court of Appeal committed an error of law when it required Aloha, on summary judgment, to identify evidence showing that competition is being harmed in a relevant market, to identify the competitive effects in that market, and to show that it is in competition with the NCAA. This court, in Gurabat v. HTH Court, specifically held that in order for an unfair method of competition plaintiff to show the nature of competition requirement, a showing of anti-competitive effects in the market is not required. The court said a plaintiff need not allege and prove that his or her injury was the result of the anti-competitive effect of the violation, because such a requirement would limit the causes of action to consumers and competitors of a defendant and would thus contravene this court's holdings in HMA and Davis. The court clarified that an unfair method of competition plaintiff need only prove an injury that flows from that which makes defendants' acts unlawful. That is called antitrust injury, the standing requirement. But the court held that a plaintiff need not prove anti-competitive effects in the market. Specifically, proof of antitrust injury does not necessarily require expert testimony, proof that a defendant lowered or raised prices, or that a defendant's conduct injured competition. That is the language in Gurabat. In short, this court held that a full-blown market analysis was not required.
Just that last point, no showing required that it injured competition at all? What is the showing, then, with regard to competition that is required under Gurabat, in your view?
Yes, Your Honor. I believe that Gurabat set forth that two things must be shown. First, the nature of the competition, and second, antitrust injury, that the plaintiff's injury must flow from the anti-competitive conduct. In proving the nature of competition, however, Gurabat specifically held that a plaintiff does not need to provide expert testimony, proof that a defendant lowered or raised prices, or that a defendant's conduct injured competitors. All that must be shown is how the defendant's violation negatively affected competition.
And in this case, what does the record show about how the defendant's conduct negatively affected competition? What viewed in the light most favorable for the plaintiff?
Yes, Your Honor. In this case, the plaintiff submitted evidence, ample evidence, showing that the NCAA's handbook, which gives the rules for recertification of a bowl sponsoring agency like Aloha, that the rules were applied arbitrarily and discriminatorily. The rules were inconsistent and conflicting. And in this case, while Aloha Sports was denied a recertification of its bowl game for failure to comply with some of the requirements, other bowl sponsoring agencies, such as the Houston Bowl and the Silicon Valley Classic Bowl, were recertified, and they too had failed to meet some of the requirements. So the rules were not applied in a fair manner.
Could you, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but could you help me with that? The fact that there were other instances in which, rather than a complete decertification, there was a finding of probation available, does that mean that in every instance, NCAA was required to place on probation a company that was unable to comply with the handbook, regardless of what the failure to comply was?
I believe so, Your Honor. I believe that the NCAA should be held to a set of rules that can be applied fairly and uniformly to all bull sponsoring agencies. If they can pick and choose which bull agencies had violations where they require decertification and others only require probation, then there is uncertainty in the market. There's an arbitrary process, and such arbitrary processes have been held to be anti-competitive, especially where there's a showing that the process could be tainted by animus, as there was here. And that, Your Honor, I'm referring to the L.A. Memorial Coliseum case. That is a case where this is a federal case where the Raiders wanted to move to Los Angeles, to the Los Angeles Memorial Coliseum. The Rams had just moved out to Anaheim, and the NFL had rules surrounding the territories and told the L.A. Memorial Coliseum that they could not move. Well, they could have moved with a vote of 3/4 of the ownership of the NFL teams, but because the plaintiffs submitted evidence that the voting would be subjective, that it was an arbitrary process, and that there was animus towards Al Davis, the owner of the Raiders, that the jury verdict was upheld and that there was evidence supporting anti-competitive conduct in that case.
What is the disposition that you're seeking in this case? Is it remand to the ICA or remand to circuit court?
Yes, Your Honor. We would submit that we would ask that the court reverses the motion for summary judgment and remands the case to the circuit court. We'd also ask for a finding that we've submitted sufficient evidence to meet the nature of the competition and anti-injury requirement.
What about the fact that the ICA didn't address the other points of error on the appeal, basically waiver, or that whether or not you should be judicially stopped, excuse me?
Well, I believe first procedurally that those issues are not before the court because the ICA did not address them.
So then why shouldn't it be remanded to the ICA to determine that?
Well, I guess I would say for a few reasons. First of all, I believe those arguments have been waived by the NCAA. Once the jury verdict in this case on the intentional interference claim came down, and the Aloha appealed, they were able to appeal for the first time the claim that is before you today, the paragraph 23F claim. That claim was originally dismissed back in 2008. And so when we appealed the original jury verdict on the intentional interference claim and appealed the dismissal from 2008, the NCAA had ample opportunity at that time to argue waiver and estoppel and res judicata and collateral estoppel. They did not do so. They waited until
now. This is on the first appeal, though, right?
Sorry?
Was this on the first appeal?
This was on the first appeal, yes.
Okay. So you're saying if they didn't argue it on the first appeal, they've waived any argument on it on the second appeal?
Correct.
I just wanted to get clarification what Justice Nakayama was asking for, the relief you're asking for, but it sounds like you're taking the position that it really didn't make any difference how the operator performed, even if they completely failed to comply with the handbook. Under any circumstances, they're entitled to be placed on probation. So if that's the case, would that be a position you could take in requesting summary judgment below? Because what discretion is left from your point of view to any finder of fact under your it sounds like your position is really doesn't matter if there's any compliance with the handbook. You get sort of a one shot at it. If you fail, you're put on probation, you get another chance. Am I misunderstanding your position?
I think so, Your Honor. I think our position is that the arbitrary nature of the decision resulted in a decertification of the Seattle Bowl, and the harm to Aloha in that case was that it had a deal with pro sports that was not able to proceed.
Okay, I'm still a little confused. You said it was an arbitrary decision. Well, I guess maybe you're saying it's arbitrary because the true intent of the decision was to somehow favor a different operator and allow that operator to perform. But when you say that it was arbitrary, then it calls into question whether there was a basis upon which there could be a determination that there was a violation of the handbook. And wouldn't you agree that the failure of Aloha Sports to perform pursuant to its obligation for the Seattle Bowl was such that there was at least a factual basis to find that there was a violation?
Yes, Your Honor. I think in this case, what would happen is this would go back to the trier of fact. I think this raises a question of fact. I think that, you know, I'm sure Mr. Kirtner will explain to you why he thinks the handbook was not applied in an arbitrary manner and why it gave them, they had many legitimate reasons for what they did. But our position is that that raises an issue for the trier of fact.
So you would concede that the trier of fact would be able to provide a basis upon which a violation of the handbook would lead to a decertification, a legitimate decertification of Seattle Bowl, and therefore a, if you will, prohibition for Aloha Sports to continue as the operator?
Well, if I could make a couple of points in response to your question. First is that I believe that the issue today on appeal is the question of whether Aloha properly showed the first thing it needs to show, which is antitrust injury and harm to competition. If it shows that, then, and there's a material issue of fact there, then the NCAA will get to proffer its legitimate business justifications. The jury will be able to hear those, and then at that point, the burden will shift back to Aloha to show that there was a less restrictive means for the NCAA to have acted in this situation. And then the jury will get to decide whether this was an unfair method of competition or not.
Could you address the NCAA's argument that, in effect, the plaintiff wasn't in competition with the NCAA? They're not both seeking bowls. One sort of the sanctioning or body, and the other is an entity that's in the business of putting on bowls. So how is there any competition between them? Could you please explain that and whether that is an impediment, in your view, to recovery in this case?
Sure. I think that the crux of Aloha's argument has always been that the NCAA did not follow their handbook. And as a result of not following their handbook, the bowl game was wrongly decertified. So I think that Gurabot requires us to allege the nature of the competition, which I believe we have done. We have shown that this was a restriction in output because the game did not occur, and that this did not just harm Aloha, but it also harmed consumers who were deprived of a bowl game. It harmed colleges who could not participate and gain financially from participating. Colleges get a minimum payout of $750,000 for participating, and it harmed Aloha. I also believe that it harms all bowl sponsoring agencies equally because of the process not being fair and being done in an arbitrary manner. But
I take it what you're saying is the fact that they're not directly in competition isn't preclude recovery, and if so, why?
Because HMA and David Davis and Gurabot have repeatedly held that a plaintiff need not be in competition with the defendant. So that is not a ground to grant summary judgment against Aloha. And the reason for that is because the standing requirements under Section 480.13a allow any person to bring a claim for unfair methods of competition. I also wanted to point out that I believe that there's a lot of confusion in other courts based on the Gurabot decision, and based on, you know, maybe conflicting results in the federal courts, and that, you know, for example, in the Kaiser Foundation Health Plan v. Hawaii Life Flight case, which is a federal district court opinion from Hawaii, they dismissed Hawaii Life Flight's unfair method of competition claim because it did not include proof of a relevant geographic market and demonstration of actual detrimental competitive effects, such as output decreases or price increases within those markets. And so there is confusion among the courts, and we brought this appeal so that we could further understand what would be required. We do believe that we've met the nature of competition and the antitrust injury prongs, as I've explained. We have shown harm not just to ourselves, but to consumers, to colleges, and to bull sponsoring agencies generally. We've also shown a competition-reducing aspect here because there was an output restriction, and so competition.
I'm sorry, I missed that. There was what kind of a restriction?
Output restriction. Restrictions on output are paradigmatic examples of restraints of trade, and so we believe that we have met all the prongs in Gurabot. Also, Aloha has shown antitrust injury because its harm here, which was the decertification of its bowl game and the resultant failure of it to be able to transfer ownership to pro sports, by virtue of that, it lost over $1 million in revenue. And that harm directly results and flows from the anti-competitive conduct here, which is the arbitrary and discriminatory application of the handbook. So we believe that we've met both prongs of the Gurabot requirement.
Very well. Anything further at this time?
I'm sorry. I'm just reaching a little bit.
I didn't realize Justice Wilson had a question, please.
I was just she's noticed I was looking confused. So I was just reaching a bit for the completing of the thought of the arbitrariness. And I think I understand the arbitrariness you're referring to is the fact that the motive for the decision to decertify was something that was not based on actually the violations that took place, the failure to comply with the handbook. It was actually more of a strategy to pass on the Seattle Bowl to a different operator.
That's correct, Your Honor. We believe in this case that the evidence shows that Pro Sports was going to take over this game. It was going that the evidence shows the NCAA thought the Seattle Bowl was going well. They wanted the game to continue in Seattle, and they just didn't want Aloha to profit off of their transfer to Pro Sports. They met with Pro Sports. They understood they had a letter of credit ready to go. They understood they could pay off any debts that were left over by Aloha. And instead of putting them Aloha on probation, letting Pro Sports take over, they, you know, jabbed the dagger in the heart and sent Aloha packing, and resulted in no bowl game at all. They did thereafter invite Pro Sports to apply for its own certification. So they clearly were interested in the Seattle Bowl and clearly interested in Pro Sports taking it over. They just didn't want to see Aloha Sports profit off of selling its bowl game.
On the other hand, if the decision was made based on the fact that they had no confidence that Aloha would be able to perform because of its failure in the past, would you say that would not be an arbitrary decision?
I think they need to follow their handbook, and if the handbook says they're supposed to be put on probation, then they should be put on probation,
okay,
just like the other bowl games who didn't meet requirements did.
All
but
right.
I believe that's a question of fact for the jury.
I guess I want to understand how expansive you see the rule that you're advocating for us today. Would you say that in any case where there's a party in the middle of a transaction and two other folks or parties vying for a contract or some to enter into some kind of agreement with that third party that's in the middle, and that transaction goes south, is that always going to be a UMOC claim, or is there something particular about the nature of the NCAA and its role in this case that would distinguish that? And if so, what is it that's special or unique, or do you think that, no, any sort of situation like this where a party in the middle of a with two people vying for business has some standards that arguably weren't followed, does that mean we have a UMA?
No, I think this is a unique situation. The cases that we've cited, the NCAA versus Regents case, the cases involving the NFL, like the LA Memorial Coliseum case that I've talked about, these are special cases. The NCAA, by virtue of its organization, restrains trade, and that was held in Regents versus NCAA.
Who else is certifying college football bowl games?
Who else is?
Yeah, who else besides NCAA?
I believe only the NCAA.
Well, isn't that a significant fact? Doesn't that set it different from all other third-party?
I agree, and what I'm getting at, and maybe inartfully, is that the U.S. Supreme Court has held that the rule of reason should apply when the NCAA rules are at issue, even if it's a per se violation, such as a restriction on output, because of the nature of the NCAA and its structure and its goals. And so I do think this is a unique case. I wouldn't argue that in every case it's an unfair method of competition, but the key thing with the NCAA is they are a rulemaking body. They make rules, and the rules need to be followed. And in other cases where there are bodies similar to the NCAA, like the NFL, courts have held where the rules are not followed, where they're subjectively applied, and where they're motivated by animus, that can be anti-competitive conduct.
I have a question. Does the record reflect whether the NCAA had anything to gain financially from decertifying Aloha Sports and dealing directly with pro sports?
I don't believe that they had anything to gain financially. I think this was more motivated by animus towards the owner, Terry Daw.
So there wasn't like an application fee that would exceed like a transfer fee or something like that?
I don't believe so.
Thank you.
I see that my time is up, so I will turn the microphone over to Mr. Kirtner. All right.
Very well. Thank you, Mr. Kirtner.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning.
This case does not present any compelling or broadly interesting or...
Could you turn the light off, please? I'm sorry. Thank you.
Important issue under Hawaiian law that needs to be resolved. It provides a straightforward application of summary judgment law, which is well settled. Both of the lower courts granted summary judgment on the one remaining claim after the prior proceedings and the prior appeal, which was under paragraph 23F of the third amended complaint, which asserted a theory, which they now want to run away from, that the NCAA was somehow in competition with Aloha Sports to do business with pro sports. That made no sense at the time, but that was their theory. And they said as recently as page 21 of their brief to the ICA that was their theory. And it in no way implicates competition of any kind. And so what happened and what the circuit court said and what the ICA said was that while it may have stated a theory at the pleading stage under paragraph 23F, it was a little unusual, but they let them go because at the pleading stage the ties go in favor of the plaintiff. The NCAA came in with abundant evidence on summary judgment that said that they didn't have a bad motive, that they didn't operate unfairly, that they didn't operate discriminatorily, that they had good cause to refuse to certify Aloha Sports Seattle Bowl for another year.
That isn't a factual issue that's supposed to be determined by a jury. I mean, I understand your argument, but they have lots of arguments too, and they've got at least three different documents that say it should have been handled by a probation and not decertifying. They have conversation. I mean, to say that all the facts are on one side is a little, at least seems difficult to grasp.
With respect, Your Honor, they did not controvert any of the facts put forward by the NCAA, that the committee had more than abundant good cause not to recertify this bowl, that it didn't pay its bills, that it didn't pay its taxes, that it didn't pay the schools, that it put on a game that was unsafe and unfair to the student athletes. They didn't trust these folks anymore. The only thing they pointed to in response, as you allude to, is the argument that the NCAA failed to comply with its handbook. It did comply with its handbook. The handbook in each and every year provided that if the management fails to comply with the rules, the NCAA has the option to withhold certification for the postseason bowl game for 1 year.
Isn't that a factual issue, though, Mr. Kirtner?
No, there's no issue. That's what it says.
Didn't Ms. Brantley just say that it was motivated? You said that they had no evidence of bad motive, but she's arguing that there is evidence of bad motive. Is that a factual issue?
They put no evidence before the circuit judge on summary judgment of bad motive.
How do you prove
Every
that there's no animus?
Testified to the same thing.
How does the move on actually establish that there is no animus?
So what the testimony that we put before the circuit court, I should say these are all the same issues that we tried.
That's direct evidence, right? But is there no possibility of circumstantial evidence of animus?
So of course there would be, but they presented none. I mean, unless you can infer it simply from the facts were that the NCAA committee had more than good reason to not want to recertify these folks. They were a bad operator.
What about the others that were placed on probation? Were they good operators?
One of them was brand new and ultimately got decertified.
I'm sorry? I thought there were two that were placed on probation.
They were both brand new they weren't put on probation. So the probation rule came in during this time period, and they were put on probation, but they didn't have a long track record of failing to comply. They were relatively new, and they were having trouble getting their papers together.
I see. So Aloha Sports did have a long track record of failing to perform.
Aloha Sports was successful for many years when it was in Hawaii, when it was owned by Leonard Klompas. When it was sold to Mr. Rolfing in 2001, it went downhill, and it went steadily downhill year after year. And then it moved to the mainland, and it put on two bowls in Seattle. They both were bad. They took $250,000.
So were they on? I see. So, if the rules were in effect, they could have been placed on probation the year before.
They could have been decertified the year before, right?
But the probation rule came into effect this year, in question.
That's right. And what the
so you didn't have a probation rule before, which would have allowed you to put them on probation the year before.
The probation rule was a floor, not a ceiling. However, what it said was, if a bowl fails to comply, they must be put on probation. But the language that I read was also still in the handbook that they may be decertified or certification.
Where does that must language come from?
That was the new language, the probation language.
Is there a question of fact as to how to reconcile those two provisions?
I think it's a question of law, actually, how to read a handbook. It's a document. We tried all these issues for days and weeks in front of Judge Sakamoto. A jury already heard all this evidence. This exact same dispute about probation versus decertification. I cross-examined people for days on these exact minute issues.
As to what theory of law again?
Under tortious interference.
Tortious interference, which has different elements than UMOC.
That's right, but it was the exactly same facts.
But summary judgment wasn't granted on collateral estoppel, was it?
Yes, it was. That was an alternate holding of Judge Sakamoto.
But is that before us?
I believe that you can affirm on alternate grounds on collateral
estoppel.
Even though
they haven't been addressed?
Well, they were addressed in the briefs below. They were not addressed by the ICA. It didn't feel the need to reach it. But the law is clear that you can affirm on alternate grounds.
What are the elements of tortious interference?
Well, a wrongful act, which is also an element of UMOC, and we don't have a wrongful act. There's no wrongful act.
But we don't, wait, what are the other elements of tortious interference?
Well, without justification that causes a business harm, I don't have them right in front of me. And that's what we tried, and the jury unanimously rejected. These are the same exact facts. Now, in terms of responding to your question, you can also affirm on the alternate ground that counsel, Mr. Bleacher, who has now passed away during the course of the 14 years this case has been pending, explicitly waived the claim that we're here on today
but
before
these,
we tried.
These issues haven't been briefed to us. We're here based on the rulings that the ICA made, which is essentially three rulings that the ICA made, and one requiring that Aloha Sports failed to specify the relevant market, Aloha Sports did not demonstrate an actual harm to the market, and Aloha Sports did not demonstrate it was a competitor of or in competition with the NCAA. That's what's before.
Well, that's what the ICA actually said was that it was affirming summary judgment on the grounds that the NCAA rebutted any inference of wrongful conduct or wrongful intent by showing that it had good cause, abundant good cause, to not recertify, and that that was enough. And secondly, that the plaintiff had failed to show any harm to competition. Now, counsel argues that Gurabot did away with that requirement. That's not what Gurabot says. Gurabot is in agreement with Davis and says that the conduct of the defendant will negatively affect competition. Not just that it might somehow in an imaginary world affect competition.
But that's what has to be proved at trial.
It has to also be substantiated at summary judgment.
But
and
how was it in Gurabot, how did the court rule on that issue?
In Gurabot, the plaintiff had a valid theory of harm to competition.
Exactly.
Theory. And had evidence. And this plaintiff does not.
I think the requirement is that it be shown how it may harm. That's the language that's used in Gurabot.
Well, what it says is will negatively affect competition. Then in a later passage it says a plaintiff is only required to prove that a defendant's conduct is harmful to fair competition. It negatively affects competition by showing that the defendant's conduct enables the defendant to create incentives for customers to purchase services elsewhere. I mean, it requires a theory of harm to competition. We don't have that here. Well, there is no comprehensible theory of harm to competition.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, Mr. Kirtner, but while you're on that, maybe you could help me with the analysis that would suggest, and I think this is the proposition that's being offered by Aloha Sports, the proposition that would suggest that if you've got a handbook that says, and I think there's a provision, and correct me if I'm wrong, in the 2002-2003 handbook that says if a sponsoring agency fails to meet the certification requirements, it shall be placed on probation for 1 year. Now, you've quoted, I guess, a provision of the handbook that you think, in fact, says that it's not necessary to put a failing operator on probation. But if you assume that that's a provision in the handbook, which it seems to be, and then the jury determines that actually what's going on here is that there is not a commitment by NCAA to follow the handbook. They're, in fact, making decisions based on which operator they prefer for other criteria that are outside the handbook, and they're an exclusive operator, exclusive certifier. So that affects competition because fewer entities would be willing to participate in a process like that where there's actually an agenda separate from the handbook that's being used to select operators.
So The language that I quoted comes after that language, and it says that the committee retains the right to withhold certification for failure to comply with the rules. Both sets of language were in the handbook in the year in question, and the only way to read them consistently is to say that probation is an option and
well,
that decertification.
I mean, you have a certain point. I mean, if there's no discretion and the NCAA always has to put an operator back on probation, you would think that that would remove from the NCAA the opportunity to remove operators that are just failing. So I understand that point of view, but on the other hand, if it's subject to interpretation such that there is a sort of mandatory notion within the handbook, then the jury gets to determine whether there is an alternative agenda and whether that agenda would affect competition. I think that's the proposition.
But we tried all those issues as to whether there was some other theory and there was some agenda, there was some extraneous motives under the claim of tortious interference. And counsel, Mr. Bleacher, waived this claim before we went to trial on the intentional interference
claim. So you're saying UMOC was waived?
Yes, it was, and judicial estoppel. He explicitly said, we are waiving every other claim which may have been pled, including the UMOC claim. We cannot meet the standards required by Davis.
Well,
that's what he said
this.
To Judge Sakamoto.
So what should this case, if we feel that Ms. Brantley has a point, should this case go back to the ICA for them to decide whether the UMOC claim was waived?
That would be one option, but this court, under its precedent, clearly has the authority to affirm on alternate grounds, which were presented below. But you could ask the ICA to address
it. But they
it
haven't
first.
Addressed it.
They
okay.
did not. That's they chose not to. They said that summary judgment was enough. So I just want to throw out an example. We have regulated activities in our world all the time. The State Bar of Hawaii regulates lawyers, and sometimes lawyers don't pay their bills, don't take care of their clients. They run a lousy practice. You might get a lawyer.
We actually regulate the bar.
Well,
in
I know
Hawaii.
You do now, and
it's a unified bar.
But sometimes you have to discipline a lawyer, and they might be disciplined for a year. That does not affect competition. That's actually good for competition. That makes competition better to get bad actors out of the marketplace, whether it's for a period of time or forever. Somebody has to do this regulating.
Okay,
it is not anti-competitive.
I'm a little confused. If the claim was waived, why did Judge Sakamoto enter summary judgment on it?
Just to kind of clean up? He did all. He dismissed on four grounds: summary judgment, waiver, estoppel, and res judicata.
What do you mean he dismissed? I thought he granted SJ first. No.
He had alternate grounds.
So no. After the trial, this claim. What
wait.
Around?
No, I'm sorry. Is this a JMAL?
No.
I'm confused. I thought he granted summary judgment.
He did. On this remaining claim.
No. After the trial?
Yes.
I see.
So what happened?
So the jury wasn't instructed on UMOC?
The jury, they waived it. They said they don't want to pursue it.
There was a summary judgment after trial.
So what happened was this claim had been dismissed initially.
Right.
On the first appeal, the ICA
reinstated it.
And then we went to trial. At the beginning of trial, on the motions in limine, the day before we picked a jury, Mr. Bleacher said to the trial judge, we are not proceeding on any claim except one. We're waiving, dropping, stopping, gone, all of the others. I said, so that means everything is gone except intentional interference? Yes, that means everything is gone. It's in the transcript. We quoted it extensively.
We understand that, but I think what we're asking is how does summary judgment get granted then after a trial?
So Mr. Rolfing took the position that this claim had somehow survived. And we said we make a motion for summary judgment. If it's alive, we don't think it is.
After trial?
Right.
Mr. Rolfe made a motion to reinstate it?
Well, he claimed that it had been dismissed, but reinstated by the ICA before trial. After trial. And therefore, we said, all right, we don't think it's around anymore, but if it is, we hereby move for summary judgment. And we showed, in fact, both sides cited to the court on summary judgment trial transcripts and excerpts from the trial. That's exactly what happened. We showed what each witness testified to on this subject. And Judge Sakamoto said there was abundant evidence to rebut any inference of bad motive by the NCAA. And the ICA said, we agree. There was sufficient evidence on summary judgment, unrebutted by ASI, to rebut any inference of bad motive. And also, there was a failure to show any connection to harm to competition.
So when Judge Sakamoto decided the summary judgment motion, he took into account the testimony at trial?
Yes.
Wait, so when was the trial? I'm just curious. Do you know?
2012, I believe. I really have been in this for 14 years. There was never a theory of harm to competition other than the removal of one bad participant from a regulated activity is somehow harm. And that
that presumes that there was no arbitrariness or capriciousness in the action. So if we were to reject that and find that there's a question of fact, and I understand you would strongly disagree with that, as I understand their theory is that if the NCAA is allowed to arbitrarily apply the rules in the handbook, that has a chilling effect on competition. It took one player out of the market. The schools that might have gone to the bowl that year weren't able to go to the schools. Fans couldn't go to the game. And across the market, people would be chilled by the notion that you might invest in or pursue these opportunities and have them arbitrarily denied to you. What's your response to that argument?
So I have two responses. One is a factual one, and that is we showed that there was good cause, and that was accepted by two courts and not rebutted by the party with the burden of proof. Secondly, there is an interesting body of law, this is in federal antitrust law, that says that just simply moving or removing one competitor does not affect competition. It is a change in the marketplace, but that happens all the time. We have businesses enter and businesses exit in particular fields of activity. That is not an effect on competition. That's an effect on a competitor.
So is the argument under that law that the NC2A, even if it acted unfairly, even if it was driven by animus, since it only affected one competitor or one other entity in the field, then it's okay under federal law? Is that?
That is actually the law. And while I understand that your law may go a little further than federal law and you're in charge of that, that is federal law.
So suppose there was only two sponsors of bowl games and the NCAA decided they didn't like one, maybe because of the name, personality, whatever it was, racial, let's just say they didn't like one of the entities. That would be okay under federal law.
So a plaintiff, as they did in the Los Angeles Memorial Coliseum case, could come up with a theory to competition on those facts. They could say that there were only two of them in a market and that the removal of one of them would have an adverse effect in that market. But they would have to prove that.
But isn't their theory that your actions, the NCAA's actions, were essentially they wanted to cut out Aloha Sports? They had no problem with the entity who was being sold to, Pro Sports, and in fact met them secretly and said, hey, come back and apply next year and we'll accept you. We just don't want anybody who has anything to do with Aloha Sports to have any contact involvement whatsoever. I mean, that's okay.
So that's close to actually right. I mean, they had had enough of the operators, the people who were operating Aloha Sports. They couldn't operate a good ball, and it was dangerous to the schools and the players and the public.
But didn't they know that Aloha Sports was negotiating a sale?
They did know. Yes, they were advised.
So they were already aware that Aloha Sports wouldn't be at putting everybody at risk as you...
What the evidence shows is that the management was going to continue. And so they were going to be dealing with the same employees. The person from Aloha Sports, Mr. Daw and Mr. Howe, it seemed like they were going to continue.
So you could torpedo a sale to a corporation because you didn't like specific individuals? I mean, that's basically what you're saying you guys did, and it was fine.
Well, that was the tortious interference theory. That was tried. The jury rejected that.
Actually, so now going back on the procedural background, before the first trial, the judge had dismissed the UMOC claim.
The first time around.
Right. And then it was reinstated by...
Part of it.
Well, okay. The ICA did allow a UMOC claim to proceed, correct, on the first appeal?
On one paragraph. 23.
And then you moved a new trial date was set.
Right.
And you moved for summary judgment.
No. We were prepared to go to trial on the UMOC claim.
Right, but you moved for summary judgment.
No, and after the trial, we moved for summary judgment.
I see.
Because they said, no, we didn't waive it.
I see.
So you... Did anyone submit a dismissal or order of dismissal after that representation was made? And does the record reflect why not?
So it's on the record, and I believe, I can't remember the exact form of order that was entered, but there are orders on all of this. Since it had already been dismissed and there was an order dismissing it, I don't think we felt that we needed to have an order dismissing it again.
You had a dismissal of the UMOC claim before the first trial.
Right.
They appealed the first trial. The ICA vacated, remanded. The circuit court set for trial. You filed a motion for summary judgment, which was granted. There was another trial date set.
But we actually had the trial.
Well, you had the first trial, but you didn't have the second trial because you got summary judgment, right? No?
I don't know that a second trial date was ever set.
Trial. I don't know exactly what date it was. Because a motion for summary judgment is a pre-trial motion.
Correct.
That's why I was asking you, is it as a JMAL? Because it wasn't making any sense to me. You would file a motion for judgment as a matter of law after a trial. But a motion for summary judgment has to be filed at least 50 days before trial.
Right.
So there was a trial date. This was an MSJ. They're appealing an MSJ. The issue is whether or not there are genuine issues of material fact that would have precluded summary judgment.
Certainly, that's the ground on which the ICA affirmed.
Right.
And you're right about that. But we also thought that this claim had been voluntarily dismissed and waived at the start of the trial.
Well, that's...
Because
well, the,
Mr. Bleacher Mr. said, D- we are... We're
he
not
made that statement, but this was after... How could he proceed when the court had already dismissed the UMOC claim? The court had already dismissed the UMOC claim before the first trial, based on your motion.
I may have my dates wrong, and I stand to be corrected. I believe that it had already been remanded prior to the trial, and it was hanging out there.
Remanded from the ICA?
On the first appeal. I apologize. I don't have that date. And I don't think it matters whether it was lingering or whether the remand came after, because we made a proper motion. And the plaintiff had voluntarily dismissed everything that they had pledged.
No, they had already dismissed. The court, you filed a motion to dismiss the second amended complaint in August of 2007, including the UMOC claim, which the court
the
granted.
Motion, yes.
Right. And then you went to trial on tortious interference. But in terms of estoppel, isn't intent a requirement of tortious interference?
Yes.
Is intent a requirement of a UMOC claim?
No. And some form of generalized intent on tortious interference. Sometimes specific intent, but the facts are the same, and so that.
But the jury could have ruled on interference with contract, tortious interference based on a lack of intent.
They found no wrongful act, but intent was...
I'm sorry. You say they found no wrongful act, so this was a special verdict form with questions?
There was question number one, do you find, I've forgotten the exact words.
Okay. Was it wrongful act?
Yeah. No, it was, do you find tortious interference?
I'm sorry. Let's be specific here. Please be careful with your representations. You're saying, so it's not that they found no wrongful act. They found, which is, the question was whether or not there was tortious interference.
That's my best recollection of
all
the
right.
question.
All right. So if so, I'm sure the jury was instructed on the elements of tortious interference, which sounds like whether it was intentional or specific intent, that would have been a part of what the jury would have had to find in order to find tortious interference. We don't know what basis on which the jury found lack of tortious interference. We don't know whether it was based on lack of intent, even if they thought that something was wrongful about what the NCAA had done. So I don't think, based on if this understanding is correct, I don't think you prevail on a estoppel or waiver or res judicata collateral estoppel type theory.
Well, so I would agree that the elements are different. And that you can't tell what the jury found, but the factual issues were exactly the same. And
we wouldn't be here if the UMOC claim had not been dismissed on the first trial, and assuming that the court had instructed the jury properly on the UMOC claim for the first trial and you prevailed, we wouldn't be here. But that's the issue, right? The jury never got to hear a UMOC claim.
Because Mr. Bleacher said they didn't want to proceed on their UMOC claim.
And is that the first trial or the second trial?
It was only one trial.
It was you moved for dismissal. You got your dismissal of the UMOC claim. And then later on, what can he say? He says, we're not proceeding on the UMOC claim. The claim had already been dismissed based on your motion. How could he proceed on a UMOC claim?
Well, that's
could he
answer.
Insist, no, Judge, you dismissed it, but you instruct the jury on the UMOC?
So that's why I'm saying there was a UMOC claim left at that time, and he decided not to proceed on it.
Oh, there was a different UMOC claim.
It was unclear. I apologize. I would have to check. He said we are dropping it, and they also had a contract claim that he dropped.
Okay.
And we're only proceeding on one theory. It
okay.
came as a surprise to us. We didn't proceed on that because of his representation to the trial judge. So, thank you. My time is up. There is not a cognizable theory of harm to competition here. Even if it was a discriminatory or wrongful act towards one entity in the regulatory process, there's no harm to competition. The number of bowl games didn't change. It was 22 to 24 year in and year out. It's now up to some 40-some. The number of participants hasn't changed. The number of fans goes up every year. There's been no harm to competition shown by this plaintiff. They might have come up with some theory, but they didn't. And there's no reason to be concerned about a UMOC claim here.
Their claim, if I understood it, was in that following year, this bowl didn't take place, and that was a harm to competition.
They could have come back and reapplied. Pro Sports could have come back and reapplied.
Who could have reapplied?
Sorry?
Aloha Bowl could have reapplied?
Yes.
After what you just stated, that you folks didn't want them to have anything to do with it?
They could have come back and reapplied the following year and said, we have new management, we've turned over a new leaf, we've got new funding, we've paid everybody off. They would have been welcome. Absolutely. The evidence is clear that this committee wants bowl games because the membership of the NCAA wants bowl games. They like to play in the postseason, but they want fair games, and they want games that are not going to injure student athletes, and they want well-run games. And that was the concern. But everybody, you can apply for one. I can apply for one any year. Thank you.
Anything further at this time, Mr. Curtin?
No. Thank you, sir.
Very well. Thank you. Please, your rebuttal. Ms. Brantley.
Thank you, Your Honor. I first just want to clear up the record a little bit on the timing of the supposed waiver of this claim. In February of 2008, the NCAA moved to dismiss the specific paragraph in the complaint that is before you today, paragraph 23F, the unfair transfer of the bowl game to pro sports. They moved to dismiss that claim, and the circuit court dismissed it. Thereafter, other unfair method of competition claims went forward, as well as the intentional interference claim and others. In September of 2011, Aloha dismissed its remaining claims. So the 23F claim that's before you today was not before the court at that point. The final judgment that was entered, paragraph 4 of the final judgment, dismissed only the remaining, this is a quote, remaining claims in the first cause of action of the third amended complaint, claiming a violation of HRS section 480-2.
Just to understand what you're saying, is the claim that we're here talking about today was dismissed pre-trial back in 08.
Right.
When there was a dismissal there was a dismissal of the remaining claims. That claim still was in play in the sense that it had not been dismissed, went up on appeal, the ICA found there had been sufficient pleading and sent it back. Is that
correct?
Your position?
Well said. Well said, Your Honor.
I should apply to be a judge. So,
I wanted to clear that up, that we do not believe that claim was waived. But in any event, this waiver issue was not raised when the issue went back up on appeal. So, I think it has been.
What about the suggestion that the evidence in the record was clear that there was no abuse or arbitrariness in the decision, that the, I take it, overwhelming and indisputed evidence was that the NCAA was simply trying to take out or eliminate someone who they had concluded could no longer adequately, fairly, and safely run a bowl game?
Well, I disagree with Mr. Kirtner's representation that there was no evidence presented on an animus, a showing of animus. Just to address that quickly, in our application for certification on page 11, we cite to some deposition testimony where I'll find it for you real quickly. We reference that this is a quote from the deposition, there was a lot of tension between Dennis and Terry. Dennis is the NCAA managing director, and Terry was the owner of Aloha, and Dennis did not like Terry at all. Also, there's evidence in the record that Terry Daw, the owner of Aloha, did not show up at the recertification meetings because he knew he was not well-liked, and he thought it was better if he stayed away, and that Mr. Feller, the CEO of Pro Sports, proceeded in his place. So there was evidence in the record. There's also plenty of evidence in the record about the handbook, and there are different provisions that are confusing. I disagree that that's a legal issue. I believe that's an issue of fact for the jury of what motivated the decision to cut Aloha loose. The other thing that I wanted to mention is that I disagree with Mr. Kirtner's assertion that federal law would not accept harm to one competitor. You cannot just have harm to a competitor. You have to have harm to competition. I believe I hopefully have explained to you why I believe competition has been harmed. But in the Clores case, which is a U.S. Supreme Court case, the Supreme Court said that anti-competitive conduct is not to be tolerated merely because the victim is just one merchant whose business is so small that his destruction makes little difference to the economy. In other words, even though competition as a whole was not reduced, the Supreme Court still held that this was a violation of the Sherman Act. In the Clores case, there were Clores and Broadway both sold household appliances, and the allegation from Chloris was that Broadway entered into agreements with manufacturers and distributors to refuse to sell to Chloris and to give them discriminatory pricing. And the argument from Broadway was the similarest to what Mr. Kirtner was saying, that, well, you know, competition as a whole couldn't be harmed. There's hundreds of merchants. This is just one merchant that's been harmed. And the Supreme Court rejected that assertion. And Chloris is still good law. The other issue that I just want to briefly address is that I agree with Justice Pollack that the harm in Gurabot did not show, there wasn't a showing of actual competitive effects. You know, a clear reading of that case shows that the two experts who opined in that case were theorizing, and they were showing how competition was harmed, and that's the holding in Gurabot. You have to show how competition was harmed. I do believe there is evidence in the record that shows that competition was harmed here by the restriction in output, the fact that the bowl game didn't go forward, that consumers were harmed, colleges were harmed. I've gone through that all with you, but I just wanted to reiterate that point. And I just want to conclude by saying that, you know, while we are talking a lot about the federal antitrust statutes, and I know that it provides guidance to Hawaii, to the court, and under the unfair competition law in Hawaii, that in Davis and in Roberts, Hawaii, it's been very clearly said by the courts that there should be a liberal interpretation of Hawaii statute. And while the federal courts should serve as guidance to this court, it should not be a should not confine Hawaii law, and that it is clear that the Chapter 480 is much broader than the Sherman or the Clayton Acts.
Very well. Anything further at this time?
I think so. Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you to both of our attorneys here today. The court will take this matter under advisement.